The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to the program. Joseph Coughlin, PhD, and founder and director of the Age Lab at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, is our guest. He is also the author of The Longevity Economy, a book that is subtitled Inside the World's Fastest Growing, Most Misunderstood Market. He is currently at work on another book, which is about the future of retirement. As a researcher, teacher, and speaker, Dr. Coughlin is a frequent guest on news programs. His work has been featured both in print and electronically in outlets such as ABC, the BBC, CNN, NBC, as well as The Economist, The Financial Times, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, among others. He joins us by phone from, I believe, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Joseph Coughlin, welcome to Author Spotlight.
Hey, it's great to be here, and indeed I am sitting here on the MIT campus.
There we go, MIT, one of the great brand names in higher education. So, and I have to tell you, Joe, as a misunderstood aging male, I'm especially anxious to hear what you have to say about so many people in my age category and beyond, and what the research has to say. And in fact, some of the research I came across is that someone turns 65 every 8 seconds, and the over 50 market in the United States now numbers more than 100 million people. And according to Oxford Economics, that's likely to swell by an additional one-third during the next 20 years. So we're looking at maybe about 135 million, 140 million soon. And then in the private wealth business, which Real Assets Advisor covers, for which I'm the editor, there's a lot of talk these days about longevity risk among investors. So in other words, people who are actually outliving their retirement dollars, which is a pretty scary prospect. But Joe, let's start with the title of your book. What is the longevity economy? Define that, please.
Well, thanks again for having me. Yes, indeed, the longevity economy is essentially the way that your listeners should think about it. This is an entire emerging market that is hiding in plain sight right in front of them. Think about the following, is that the longevity economy, as I define it, and other researchers are looking at this vast number of older adults that are not just older people in more numbers, but this new class of consumers that expects to live longer and better. So you're mentioning people turning 65 every 7 or 8 seconds. Imagine this, the baby boomers, those folks, a large generation, the second largest and certainly among the loudest, born between 1946 and 64, they're turning now 74 every 7 to 8 seconds. But here's the kicker. This group is more educated than any previous generation in history. They have more money. They, in fact, the 60-plus worldwide make up the third largest buying power after the gross domestic product of the U.S., after China, and then the 60-plus. But here in the United States, the longevity economy, the 50-plus, is actually making up 70% of the buying power in the U.S. So the longevity economy is about a whole new emerging market of expectations, of old age being better than what your parents and grandparents had before, and they are now looking to be excited and delighted.
So let me ask you about this. We have seen television shows that got pulled really terrific ratings, and then they were taken off the air. And the reason being that the audience was too old. Advertisers aren't interested in people past the age of, I'm not sure what the demarcation point is, 50, 55, because they're locked into their buying patterns. They've been using Crest toothpaste their whole life, and they're not going to go to Colgate. They're not going to change their brand of automobile, and they're in the years when they're going to spend less money anyway. So what about that? I mean, let's talk a little bit about perception versus reality. If you were sitting in a room with TV executives who had this attitude, would you say, hey, that's about right, that's true, or would you say you've got, you know, you're misunderstanding that market?
You know, it is amazing because actually your numbers are even more optimistic than the reality. The reality is they really only want to be able to get essentially the 18 to 35-year-old market, and then by about 36, you're starting to fade from interest, with a few exceptions maybe of folks looking in their early 40s at tops. No, the fact of the matter is that with this much buying power, they are missing the point because, in fact, they will change brands, if you will. So, for instance, think about the people today that are driving Toyotas and Mercedes and other cars. This was the generation that grew up saying, buy American. And by the way, if it wasn't Ford or GM or Chrysler, dropped it like a hot potato. This is certainly a generation that may have had their preferences, but preferences can be changed. Imagine the following, that only 2% of the advertising budgets out there today in television and radio and the like, in print, go to looking at the 50-plus. And yet the 50-plus have 70% of the buying power. Not only are they more educated, though, but they're also more tech-savvy. This is a generation that did invent the Internet, did see the Apollo moon landing, and in fact, if you look at certain categories such as iPads and smartphones, and iPads are one of the leading groups purchasing, and more than 60% of the 50-plus have smartphones. So indeed, they are making a big mistake because the people who buy high-tech, high-style, and high-priced are actually 50-plus. The average age, for instance, just again looking at automobiles, of luxury vehicles are not people under age 50. They are well into their 50s, and for some brands, even though it makes them cringe, they are in their 60s.
Interesting. So the axiom goes like this. An aging population, and we have a lot of aging populations around the world today, it adds up to an economy that's in trouble. It's destined to slow to a crawl for a variety of reasons, including that seniors don't spend as much. They are fixed in their attitudes and purchasing patterns. You've already dispelled some of those ideas. They have outdated skills. They're not interested in learning new things. And as a group, they have their most productive years are really behind them, and their best creative thinking years are behind them. So witness Japan and Italy as an example. Germany was losing population. They just actually had an uptick in the birth rate over there. But what's your rejoinder to that stereotype? Are you of the mind that, yeah, an aging economy, if you have a low birth rate and rising ages among your population, you are going to have a substandard economy, or do you think that's an outdated postulation?
I think it's now dated, but remember, things that are dated are based upon stories. So while economists love their numbers and love their spreadsheets, the assumptions that go into that so-called objective analysis are based upon myths and stories of the past. So just to kind of go off on a little bit of a tangent, old age, as I like to say in my book, The Longevity Economy, is in fact made up. Do you know that was actually made up around the idea of vital energy from the 1800s largely? That is that you were born with a certain amount of energy, and if you used it badly, which by the way meant anything fun, you would simply start to deplete that energy, much like a half a glass of water going down to a quarter of a glass and the like. In fact, what would happen when you lose energy? You'd be tired. In fact, you'd be so tired that you would need to retire. We actually created a whole language out of the medical literature, British medical literature in the 1800s, about this notion of vital energy, and then started building up institutions around it. We started building up institutions that reinforced the story and behaviors. So think about it. We started to create retirement homes and nursing homes, and right after that we know the phrase that used to be used years ago were funeral homes. We created retirement because, remember, manufacturing and productivity and the like was based upon physical labor. And every man, and basically men, were not people that were doing work. They were cogs in a wheel. And so if they get slower or weaker or more likely to get hurt, you want them out of there. So you created this notion of retirement so you could bring in new, younger, more vital cogs in the wheels. Well, now that we have so much of the economy that, shall we say, is white-collar or knowledge-based, yes, there are many, many people doing physical labor that have a great deal of challenges ahead of them. But the fact is that this notion of retirement has changed, and our institutions have not changed with it. With respect to the economy, one of the challenges about the older adults not changing brands or buying new things, I would ask business the following, as we do here in the lab. I have more than 40 companies that sponsor research here at the MIT Age Lab. When was the last time you heard a company say, what can we build to excite and delight the older consumer? Do we only build housing that's premised on providing care? Do we only build devices that are big, beige, and boring that remind us to take our medications? And we never mention the F word with older adults. You know what I mean. Fun. Friends, even fashion. So the bottom line is that it is not older age that is slowing the economy. It is not the older consumer that is stayed. It is an old story that business and governments have gravitated to that was so true for many years that they are reluctant to see the change right in front of them in plain sight.
Interesting. So let's go a little deeper on the business side then, because before we started recording, I was talking to you about senior housing, and you had some statistics on that, that people, for instance, I was saying that the senior housing sector of real estate, that particular property type or niche property type, has been pretty hot lately. The actual arrival, though, of how this market has developed, you said, was actually a little ahead of the curve. Why don't you, for our listeners, reiterate what you were telling me about the stats there?
Sure. I mean, the senior housing industry is certainly hot. That is, it's hot with investment and building. But we should look at the stats very carefully. And one of the challenges I think all of us are having in the era of big data is that we have data everywhere and not a drop of insight. So while we look at the aging of the population, we say, oh my gosh, lots of older people, we're going to need lots of senior housing. Not incorrect, but it may be entirely incomplete. The first part is that single-digit percentages ever see senior housing. Most of us wish to age in place, and much of the premise that we are seeing with young people driving spreadsheets about the need for new senior housing is based upon the baby boomers are getting older. But the trouble is that the average age coming in today's assisted housing is upwards of 83, 84 plus years old. The oldest baby boomer is 74. That means they will not be entering the senior housing stock easily for another decade, which means that even the capital expenses being made today will need to be refreshed, renewed, and redesigned for probably a new set of expectations that the baby boomers won't have for another 10 years. So while certainly senior housing is a healthy and necessary commodity and real estate play, I would be very wary about thinking that all seniors are the same, that the baby boomers are ready for prime time today, and that senior housing that is based solely on wellness and community may not meet the sociology of a new generation of older adults in 10 years.
So you stop and think about a population that's coming into nursing homes at such a late stage in life. Let's take my mother as an example. She was 90 years old before she went into a nursing home, and she was only there for 3 years. She didn't go into the nursing home, of course, until it was really she was failing, and she wasn't really failing for that long, and then it was over. If people are getting into the senior housing centers later in life, presumably, maybe not presumably, but there's a good chance, it stands to reason, a lot of them will probably have a short term in there. I think maybe, I don't know what the calculation, maybe you know this, Joe, what the calculations were on what they were thinking about as far as a term of occupancy was going to be for the average senior citizen who went into an assisted living facility, let's say, or a full-scale nursing facility. But it sounds like it may actually be considerably younger than they were anticipating.
I think that it was supposed to be younger, particularly in the assisted living idea, because what they were trying to create was not just a care platform, but a community and lifestyle platform. And the next generation of older adults that we're looking at have done just about everything to reject belonging to groups and to communities. Mira, this is the group that have dropped out of churches, temples, and mosques. They no longer join Rotary. They drop out of PTA once their children are gone and the like. So these communities are based upon the premise of, come here, engage, you'll be part of a community. Wow, for the first 80 years, you had people that were doing everything but to be part of a group, and now that's one of the great, shall we say, offerings that people are asking for. One of the things that I think the real estate industry needs to watch is the Internet of Things and develops around new technology that we're doing here at the lab and many companies around the world. These services are not just going to improve how they provide care in senior housing, but also may extend the ability of people to stay in their own homes, to be monitored, managed, and motivated, to have healthy behaviors in their home with distant family caregivers. And I did some back-of-the-envelope analysis a number of years ago. If I can keep older adults in their home for only 6 months longer than average, that's a possible $22 billion ding to the senior housing industry. So just think about how are the Alexas, the Google Homes, and the robots, and the various sensors that are coming across our homes for convenience in old and young age, but can provide care in old age, combined with on-demand services like Uber and food delivery and laundry and the like, creating a virtual assisted living that may in fact disrupt senior housing.
And in Japan, they're doing something pretty incredible, actually creating robots that are going to provide care, inexhaustible. You know, I mean, robots are basically inexhaustible. They can supply certain care to seniors, and I think it's not going to happen tomorrow, but I think that it's inevitable that we're going to start seeing such robots available for the home for people who can afford it.
Yeah,
and
I think it was I do think that we'll see that. I do get concerned about whether when there's no touch available, I guess without high touch, you can go high tech, but boy, what a chilly way to provide care.
Exactly. So obviously it would need to be something more than just silicon-based being there. But this whole idea, I mean, can we stipulate that the baby boom generation is different than previous generations? I know that we tend to repeat ourselves on different generations. They were supposed to bring about the end of the world, and baby boomers look at younger generations and say they're just not the same. They don't do things the same. They don't read. They don't learn. They don't do this and that. But it does really seem that baby boomers bring a different attitude into their senior years than previous generations. Is that something you have found through your research or not?
Absolutely. I mean, the very premise of the longevity economy that I write in the book is that the new generation gap is about expectations. This is a generation that as they, since the day they were born through adulthood, had schools built for them, communities built for them, redesigning retail, reinventing technology, changes in the workplace, changing on how we are promoted and the like. Do any of us genuinely believe that a generation that for 70 plus years has had everything made better, changed, or made more comfortable for them is suddenly going to wake up one day at 70 or 75 or 80 and go, well, suddenly I'm going to become like my parents. I'm going to be, frankly, more polite. I'm going to wait for the van that'll be coming a week late to pick me up. I'm going to stay home and hope that people come and visit me. Heaven forbid I won't use a telephone, I won't use the laptop, because that's something old people do not do. No, the new generation gap is demanding not to just to live longer, but to live better. We expect there's a pill, a product, a policy, or some sort of innovation out there that's going to make life tomorrow better.
So what do older people actually want? I mean, you talk about business and how, you know, kind of a chicken and egg thing where you're saying business isn't really giving people. Is it really that people are slowing down, or are people kind of falling out of the mainstream, or is it that business does not address their wants and needs and their desire to still have fun regardless of age? So what does your research say about what do senior citizens want?
I think from the research that we've done and the work that I've done with some companies and whatnot, unfortunately that story that I mentioned earlier, the story of what old age, that loss of vitality, that loss of energy, has so captivated product designers and service developers and company management and leadership that old age is something that can't be fixed. It's just as one of those, shall we say, bankruptcies that happen at a certain birthday or a certain part of society. So what do old people want? They want to be like everybody else. They want to be relevant. They want to be engaged. Frankly, they want to be employed. You know, I'll give an example. The aerospace industry, the energy industry, the agricultural industry. Do you know the average ages of people in those professions are well into their 50s? The average financial advisor is 57. The average farmer is 61. The average aerospace engineer, 56. And in energy, I'm not sure we could ever build a power plant because we've lost that knowledge of how to do it. Because while there were many people taking the package to retire, there was not a long line of people choosing those professions. So part of the big problem with the generation of older adults is not their lack of verve, their lack of want, but the lack of imagination to create a new dream, a new story of what is possible around education, around work, not just a life of leisure that was invented years ago.
So your book says that baby boomers are a population that consistently defies expectations. In what way?
Well, you know, if you think about it in terms of defying expectations, not only if they didn't like social norms, they'd change them, whether it was from birth control to marriage. If they didn't like how workplace was to be was working, they changed that. We had the birth, shall we say, mixed metaphor intended, of daycare centers, women in the workplace. In other words, this was a group that was marching nearly 80 million strong in the United States alone. The Dankai of Japan, very much like the baby boomers of Europe and the United States, are expecting more and different. And so they became the first tech-enabled generation, the most educated generation in their old age, and they've changed every institution.
Now, there is, despite all that you've said, there's a lot of ageism in the United States. You know, we're a country that's full of companies that tends not to hire older Americans. Now, you did mention that the average age of advisors tend to be, in some cases, these guys own their own shop. But it is an intellectual, it's a knowledge-based job, and you made the point that knowledge-based jobs, when it doesn't have to do with manual labor and speed, but it's knowledge-based, that an aging worker, somebody, a baby boomer, can do that job just as well or better because of their time frame and their experience and their encyclopedic memories and so on. What about it, though, your thoughts on ageism in the United States? Is that something that as the population gets older and it's becoming more difficult, there's a lot of open jobs in our country right now, is there any kind of change of heart you're seeing going on among American business?
It is so difficult. There is indeed a great deal of ageism in society today. Even as the average, even as the median age starts to approach 40 years old in the workforce out there, largely because of that story, the notion of, well, older people, as Mark Zuckerberg, I quote in my book from Facebook, said, younger people are simply smarter. Well, we'll just let that stand and let people digest that on their own terms. But the fact of the matter is that, yes, there are job openings out there now where we need to hire people because we don't have that young group of people to replace them. There are many jobs out there that young people simply do not want. And there are also jobs out there where an older touch is actually a more informed touch. So high-touch jobs that require a great deal of consumer conversation and engagement may be one. We see in some industries where high quality and craftsmanship is necessary, that going for the 40, 50, even 60-plus-year-old is a necessity so that they understand how a certain thing is to be made or the like. The bottom line is that in their minds is basically the knowledge of and the legacy of how companies have always done what they do. And when they walk out the door with the metaphorical package, they also take with them a generation of lost knowledge.
Now, another point the book makes, it talks about a new vision of a longer life among baby boomers. They've got a different vision for what longevity is going to mean. They're quote-unquote golden years are going to be vis-a-vis previous generations. Tell our listeners about what you found.
Well,
you've already covered some of this ground, I know, Joe, so yeah. You either could put it into a nutshell or expand on that point.
So, well, let me tell a little bit of the story about that new vision of longer life. In the book, I interview a large number of retired CEOs. And for anybody who's listening, you know, the highest concentration of retired CEOs in the United States happens to be in Naples, Florida, and the surrounding area. And one of the things that I found when I went down there is I wanted to find out, here are people who have money, they have great weather, they have health, but generally speaking, these are the folks who have really got it together, and they should have retirement locked up. Well, guess what? You retire, you chat with these folks, and you find that from these CEOs that they're not happy. Some of them are, of course, but a vast number that I spoke with were not happy. They did not have the information flows that were coming to them. People asking for their opinions, their decisions to be made and whatnot. There was not a place for them in their youth of early 60s, in many cases, to retire from what they were as CEOs and the like. So they were suggesting, as we're now finding people who are far less well off economically, that a new vision of longer life has to include longer work, education, volunteering with verve. In fact, entrepreneurship is among the hottest things, is amongst the 50-plus. Just, you know, stepping outside the United States for a moment, in the UK, Barclays Bank had one program called Generation E, Generation Entrepreneur, which where they were going after, as the UK calls them, pensioners that were more stable and more likely to develop new businesses that were sustainable over time. I want you to just think one quick piece of mathematics that you may find interesting. From zero birth to 21 years old, or if it's easier for some, drinking age, that is about 8,000 days. From 21 to midlife crisis, little hair over 45 or thereabouts, mathematically, is about 8,000 days. And from there to 65, I bet you're getting the algorithm now, from there to 65 years old is another 8,000 days. But if you make it to 65, you have a far better chance than 50% that you will make it to over age 85. And guess what? That is another 8,000 days. We are no longer talking about a short-term plan of trip to Disney, a cruise ship, a hug with a grandchild, and then the end. We are now talking about one-third of adult life. So that new vision is a new story that has yet to be created. And the baby boomers have the attitude, some of it bad, education, and many of them with the wealth to say, we now want to expect to live longer, but live better and not be, shall we say, put on the shelf.
You have said that women, in particular, women are likely to be the leaders in identifying the new wants and needs among the country's aging cohort. So why women, and what are they expecting to see in terms of this evolution you're talking about?
Yeah, I'm actually very happy with that chapter. It has a nice alliteration in the book, The Future is Female. And as my wife says to me, it's very nice of me to acknowledge 51% of the population. But let's digest, if you will, just a little bit of the stats and the realities. The fact of the matter is that women tend to live longer. But more importantly, they're also the caregivers. One in four American families provides upwards of 26-plus hours a week of care to an older adult. And the profile of that caregiver? It's a middle-aged woman, 47 to 57 years old. And by the way, if her partner does not have an older adult sister, by the way, guess what? That woman is likely to have far more parents to care for than she had ever planned on having children. She sees the jobs of old age. She's the one that is closer to what old age is by the time she's in her 30s, 40s, and certainly 50s as a caregiver. But something else is going on. She is more educated in nearly all fields, more educated than men in nearly all fields other than engineering, and likely to eclipse in that, since 1978 with bachelor's degrees and 1988 with graduate degrees. But here's the big thing that often business seems to ignore. And when you're talking about older people being invisible, let's put a fine point on it. Women over age 40 are virtually invisible to the market, and yet, they are the chief consumer officer of the house. They make 80 cents to 90 cents on the dollar of every decision for health care. They are the chief influencer on buying a vehicle, by far. And by the way, if it's a luxury vehicle, sometimes it goes up to as high as 86%. She's the one who chooses what's in the house, out of the house, and the like. And she's the number one influencer, not just of her parents and in-laws, her house, but even the millennials in surveys have identified their middle-aged mother as being their best friend and therefore their best advisor. And finally, to conclude, if you will, women, the new women's movement out there is entrepreneurship. Data suggests that the number two group of people starting new companies are not just our stereotype of some young guy wearing a hoodie, sneakers, and writing code, but rather a woman over age 50 starting a new business. Indeed, the future is female.
What about stealth aging? That's a term you use in the book. Tell us about that, stealth aging, just like a stealth bomber. What is stealth aging?
Yeah, I basically tweaked that around the concept I developed in there called transformational design. That is design of products and services and like that, shall we say, excite and delight. There's an old adage in the auto industry and even in the aging world, which is you can't build an old man's car. Because if you build an old man's car, a young man and a young woman won't buy it. But here's the corollary. An old man and an old woman will run with their hair on fire away from it as well. So we need to build products that are not clinical blue and big and beige and boring, that are all about medical, or to advertise, this is for old people, or this product is made for you because you can no longer hear, walk, eat well, chew, whatever it might be. But rather, how do we create new products that are personalized? Products that are easy. Talk about performance, not health deficit. These are things that are attractive to 20 and 30 and 40-something consumers and absolutely seized upon by the 50, 60, and 70 and beyond. No one ever cares about a product that is too safe, too cool, too easy, and too personalized to use. Just one example, two examples to give you. One, an old example. The microwave oven was made for convenience. Living by yourself as an older adult, that microwave oven becomes an incredible, important piece of assistive technology to heat up a meal that is balanced and fresh for you at the time of need. The tablet computer is not just an easy piece of technology, but allows me to take off my glasses, use my two fingers, crank up the font, and suddenly I'm not using an old man's device because I can't see. I'm simply personalizing the font for me on a technology that my 20-something-year-old students use as well. That is stealth design. That is transformational design.
There is definitely this anti-aging boom going on in our country as well. If you look at baby boomers, there is not just diet and exercise. Clearly, there's been, particularly among the educated portion of the populace, a lot of focus on nutrition, exercise, but there's also Botox and cosmetic surgery, and there's pharmaceuticals or kind of quasi-pharmaceuticals that are supposed to retard the aging process and so on. We seem to be obsessed with not only, there's even talk of reversing aging, I mean, if you can believe that. And they are, researchers are starting to understand what actually causes aging, at least they think they do. So my point is this, Joe. On the one hand, there's something to be said about people who understand that they're getting older, they accept it, they're age appropriate and all that. It doesn't mean they sideline themselves. I mean, they can fit all the definitions you were just laying out here, all the misconceptions about aging people. But there does seem to be a desire to try to replicate youth. Even if we can't make ourselves younger, we want to look younger. And there does seem to be an obsession with anti-aging. Just your thoughts on that. How do you see that expressing itself in the future if you spend any time on that category?
No, absolutely. Especially when I do consulting around investments and the like, you certainly see an entire growth industry around the anti-aging business. And as you were saying, whether it's hair care or cosmetics or even knee replacements that may go beyond medical and the like, are going into a generation that, while it is no longer young, wishes to always be youthful. And so I'm not going to, shall we say, criticize those folks who are not accepting, shall we say, the realities of certain changes in our bodies. And I'm not sure I would go as far as many who have characterized aging as a disease, because frankly, the alternative to aging is not nearly as pretty. I do believe that what we need to do is to come up with a new authenticity. I'm not saying that we all need to have gray hair, or in my case, I'll take any color hair. But the fact of the matter is what we need to start thinking about is, why be anti the greatest success of humankind, the ability to live longer? The paradox is not necessarily just how we look, but what is it we can do? What can we contribute? What can we achieve? How do institutions need to change and physical spaces need to be redesigned, education and workplaces rethought, to plan for a lifetime that is now approaching closer and closer to 100 years, rather than what many of these things have been premised on, which is you retire at 60 or 65 because you're going to be dead at 67. And that's the new tragedy of what anti-aging is about. It's taking some of the verve and the energy away from really inventing 8,000 days or one-third of your adult life to be bigger, better, and longer.
Now, final question. So I said at the top that you are currently, that we've been talking about the longevity economy, obviously, but the follow-on book to that is one that you're working on now about the future of retirement. Are there any let's say, movie trailer notes you can give us on that? What should we be expecting from your new book? What are some of the highlights there?
A lot of the work I do here in the lab and outside and speaking, advising and whatnot is looking at how this longevity economy is going to translate into investment and lifestyle and the like. And so as I look at the retirement population, I want you to start thinking about this is a new, entirely new life phase. The folks that are out there on this new frontier are literally hacking longevity, because the old story of it only being either about illness or leisure is incomplete for nearly everyone. So the book and the research and the work that I'm doing now is, how are people thinking new things about education? How are they starting new companies? What is the future of work? It may not be 40 hours a week of the same thing you've been doing for 40 years. Can we start thinking in terms of four or five careers in a lifetime, let alone four or five jobs over a lifetime? What is the future of love? Will my wife of already 33 years want to hear 33 more years of the same jokes I've been telling for decades? So we're starting to look at, frankly, this is a whole new horizon. And as I said at the top of our discussion, not only is this an entire emerging market hiding in plain sight, is an entire emerging global opportunity to invent life tomorrow.
So actually, I do have one more question.
Sure.
You are the founder and director of the Age Lab at MIT. What inspired you to create the Age Lab? What did you see or what happened in your life that made you decide that this was an area that needed some really focused research?
My original background is in urban planning and real estate development, transportation, essentially urban form, if you will. And it was a great paradox. We had this incredible aging population. I mean, heck, the baby boomers have been coming, as they say. You know, they're coming. Well, my God, they've been coming for nearly 75 years. And yet, we had not rethought housing, we had not rethought vehicles, we had not rethought infrastructure. And so those were areas that not only do I teach in, but was really passionately interested in, but we were left with a paradox. The greatest success of humankind was living longer. And now that we have it, countless economists, pundits, and investors, and policymakers have decided that this is somehow a crisis. I wanted to see how could we use new technology, new design, new dreams, investment strategies, and the like to invent a new life tomorrow. And so really it was a curiosity about the inevitability of demographic change in conflict with a simple story that has outlasted its utility that was created nearly 150 years ago. And so it was an academic curiosity that hopefully now is actually turning into a better story to help businesses work in this area, but also to help government and policymakers come up with a new story of what life tomorrow in old age could be.
There you have it. So our guest has been Joseph Coughlin, PhD, and as I just said, founder and director of the Age Lab at MIT. We've been talking about his book, The Longevity Economy. Joe, thanks very much. May you have a long and vigorous life, the both of us, and may the business market come to realize that we are a lot more viable and flexible than they think.
Absolutely. You too. And this has been a great delight, and I wish everyone great life and great wellness.